Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
The strength of the state will lavish on more than making of wealth and making of war. We are learning at last, though the lesson comes late, that the making of man is the task of the state. What do you think that was published? Pravda? Volkische Beobachter? Perhaps in Sojourners? Maybe Jim Wallace? I believe Wallace or Wallish? The much-discussed supporter of Mr. Obama, who's a adherent to liberation theology of the conventional leftist variety, is he the person who wrote that? No, that was published in the April 26th, 1917 issue of Christian Century magazine. I believe that the author of this perfectly blasphemous sentiment was Edward Everett Hale. Some of you may have seen that name in hymn books. That editorial, the editorial containing that piece of doggerel, was published in support of the war on Germany, America's entry into World War I, which, in my opinion, was the event that pretty much destroyed the Christian West. That's liberation theology of a sort that, unfortunately, Glenn Beck and modern militarists espouse. They don't understand that they're promoting exactly the same type of heresy, in a slightly different key, admittedly, as that Obama and his ilk are promoting. Let me see if I can find, I had it here just a second ago, a collection of potted blasphemies promoting this idea. I believe this is it. Edward Everett Hale, I mentioned him before, addressing the 1907 Congress of Religious Liberals in Boston. By liberal, of course, they're not referring necessarily to political liberals. Prophesied that, quote, as the United States is one nation, the united world is to become the one empire of the living God. Frederick Lynch, secretary of the Commission on Peace of the Rockefeller-created Federal Council of Churches, which is now the National Council of Churches, predicted in 1914 that the trend toward political consolidation would bring about what he described as, quote, a United Nations of the World. That was in 1914, bear in mind. This vision was invoked by many mainline clergy who eagerly enlisted in Woodrow Wilson's war effort. And you had mainline evangelical progressive clergy promoting World War I. Now, for the most part, people who are aware of the fact that there was something called progressive Christianity and that it was somehow involved in the ferment that led to Prohibition and a number of other so-called reform movements in the late 19th, early 20th century, they would have you believe that these people are squishy as a spoiled banana on matters of war and military policy. Quite the opposite is the case. These people eagerly promoted the idea of the state as a temporal political messiah, a messianic force that would use unalloyed coercion and mass bloodshed to bring about a better world, supposedly. One very, very good book on this subject, which unfortunately is out of print, was published by Richard Gamble a few years ago. It's called The War for Righteousness. And Mr. Gamble talks about the fact that the progressive American clergy of the late 19th, early 20th century combined a religious faith in progress with a reliance on the state, and they came to view the European war as nothing less than a sacred crusade to democratize the world at gunpoint. To the phones we go. We have a couple of people who have been waiting very patiently. Dave from Wisconsin is with us. How are you doing this evening, Dave?
Well, good evening, Will Gregg. I very seldom try to challenge anything that anyone says when I call in, but I have a point that I would like to bring up and where I disagree with you on a point.
Okay, fair enough.
You said that with the event that took place, you said the central node of the empire, and I disagree with that. I consider the central node of the empire to be Windsor Castle.
Okay. We'd agree that we're talking about an Anglo-American elite. You just disagree as to which part of the nucleus would be the central focal point of that arrangement, right?
Well, I think the for public consumption, it could be, we could agree that for public consumption, Washington D.C. would be the central node. But
okay, I think that's workable.
For the secrecy, the serious decisions that are made among the people that influence the people like Glenn Beck and others. I would say that Windsor Castle is the central node.
And then Prince Charles would be the gray eminence in that arrangement, I would assume. In a
matter of time, yes.
Yeah, but he's sort of not the incumbent dominant power within that arrangement, but he's sort of the fellow in waiting to carry out that role, correct?
Exactly. Depending upon his mother's retirement or death, the immense power of that family is little understood and it's little appreciated. And Washington, D.C. has never been completely independent from the German royalty. Not completely. The Declaration of Independence was declared, and mm-hmm. political independence is important. The American people, for a period of time, were able to draft legislation on how to conduct themselves legally. However, there are latches in the agreement that goes all the way back to the Treaty of Ghent. So it's really a complicated thing, but I don't think we are in disagreement in total. It's just a matter of the public consumption area of it, and I really have as many consternations about Glenn Beck leading some kind of a great mass movement for the very reasons that you said. So for the most part, yeah. We're in agreement, but that's
okay.
One point.
All right. You had another one?
Well, there is a recent book. It was authored in 2009, and it's titled Antichrist and the Green Prince, that has a lot of information in it regarding biblical prophecies and also a lot of factual information about the Windsor family and their illegal and illicit drug dealing for literally centuries going back in their bloodline, in their family. So
let me interject.
It's on my website.
Let me interject here very quickly. A couple of weeks ago, I referred to a book called The Imperial Cruise, which was about the 1905 cruise by William Howard Taft and the daughter of Teddy Roosevelt when they went through the Pacific and they ended up in China. And there was a passage, actually a section about 10 pages or so, that talked about the way that the great houses of finance and commerce here in the United States were really intimately bound up in the narcotics trade that was controlled by the British, particularly during the 19th century, and how this had a very large role that it played in the Pacific politics of the era, when you're talking about the opium wars that were fought by Great Britain, and then the open door policy that was later inflicted on China in the interests of mercantilism, how these huge financial empires here in the United States are all bound up in that same nasty business I think you just touched on. And that's a field of study I'd really like to get into, because I can't help but think that this monstrosity we call the drug war, which is a huge price support program basically for the narcotics industry, probably was conceived decades ago by some of the personalities you're referring to.
Well, see, here's the complication. Because of the the vast amount of power that the British have in terms of controlling news that does actually get disseminated widely, in the public mind, the British Empire is no longer attempting to conquer the world and no longer attempting to take over anything, and it's what's called a Pyrrhic victory. You know, Pyrrhic victory, yeah. Where the propaganda is. Excuse me?
Yeah, Dave, I'm going to have to catch you up. We got to go to a break here. I've got somebody else waiting, but it's really good to hear from you. We'll have to pick up this subject again soon because I'm just getting my toes dipped into it. So thanks a lot. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. This is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a minute. One 866-986-6397 is our call number, 866-986-6397. This is Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. I am William Grigg, and we go to the phones. Eric from Milwaukee has been waiting for a little while, and I appreciate him calling in. Eric, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Mr. Grigg?
I'm doing relatively well. It's been a busy day, but that's good. How may it be of service to you?
Well, what prompted my call was your reference to Mr. Kaufman, but before I bring up a couple points, I just want to say that it's an honor and privilege, actually, to talk to you.
Well, you're very kind.
Oh, I consider yourself and Mr. Kaufman as probably the most literate and perceptive commentators on U.S. history.
I'm flattered to be mentioned in the same paragraph with Mr. Kaufman. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and rather than, I'll get into it. The thing that I guess prompted my call was to reference to Mr. Kaufman and also to the founding fathers and recognizing that they weren't an assembly of demigods. And actually, there's an excellent debate that's available on the internet between Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Gary Gregg. This is through the Intercollegiate Studies Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the motion is that the Anti-Federalists were right to oppose ratification of the Constitution. I think it's kind of interesting today because you have a lot of conservatives and others saying, well, we got to restore the Constitution. But I think the real question historically is, was the Constitution itself a mistake? And if you watch that debate between Mr. Kaufman, who's supporting the Anti-Federalist side, he'll probably convince people that maybe there's some problems with the Constitution.
When did that debate take place? That's fascinating.
Yeah, I think looking back on it, you could say our problems didn't emerge just recently with Obama. Because when you really look at the history, George Washington made two big errors. He appointed Hamilton as Secretary of the Treasury, and then he supported Hamilton's interpretation over Jefferson's regarding the constitutionality of National Bank. And those things kind of set in motion implied powers and all the problems we have today.
Have you read DiLorenzo's book? Eric, have you read DiLorenzo's book, Hamilton's Curse?
Yes.
Are you aware of Thomas DiLorenzo, are you aware of a somewhat pallid reply to that in the form of a monograph entitled Hamilton's Blessing?
No, I think I might have heard Mr. DiLorenzo refer to it a couple times, but I haven't read it myself.
Well, the thing about that is that the title, Hamilton's Curse, was a play on the phrase blessing, national blessing. And that was the phrase that Hamilton applied to public debt. He said it's a blessing that the government can go into debt. And, of course, he was somebody who created this horrible corporatist framework where you had the people who were the bond-holding and bond-issuing class as the favored element in the society that – the political society, I should specify, that was envisioned in this arrangement. And just in the last couple of years, Eric, I've come to the conclusion that the people who say that the anti-federalists had the stronger argument were entirely correct on matters pertaining to the Constitution and whether you're dealing with something that on balance could be considered a blessing. I started this program about a year and a half ago with a monologue in which I said the Constitution is just the beginning point for any conversation about how to protect individual liberties, because the Constitution, while in some ways commendable, is a seriously flawed document. And I think that the best illustration of that is the provision permitting what's called eminent domain. If you've got something that's intended to limit the powers of government, why do you have this little trap door permitting the government to seize property of what it defines to be market value, fair market value? That I think is probably the Persian flaw, if you will, of the document. For those who think that the Constitution is otherwise an admirable document, there's the self-nullifying clause in the whole deal, as far as I'm concerned. And that reflects, I think, the Hamiltonian cast of the document to begin with. But when did this debate take place between Mr. Gregg and Mr. Kaufman?
I think it was a few years ago. But okay. Like I said, it's on the Internet. If you go to the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, ISI, and just search their debates for Gary Gregg or Bill Kaufman. It's actually an excellent debate.
I really appreciate you bringing that up. I had not heard of that, and that sounds like something that would be perfectly fascinating and very illuminating. That's something I intend to watch very soon.
and the other thing, too, I think, in reference to the origin of these problems very early on under the Constitution, you know, Jefferson and Madison pretty quickly saw the direction the Federalists were taking interpretation of the Constitution, and they wrote the Kentucky and Virginia Resolution. But I think the big problem they created was they wrote these great documents and said, hey, the state legislature should resist. But then they sought the presidency rather than staying at the state level and seeking nullification and, if necessary, secession. Because later on in life, Madison basically said, well, we really didn't mean nullification. And I think that also created huge problems.
Yeah, he managed to be on both sides of that position on several occasions. He really played hopscotch around the question of limited powers and interposition and nullification. And good grief, it must have been 21, 22 years ago, I read a piece in Chronicles magazine. Are you familiar with Chronicles?
Yes.
If you read Bill Kaufman, that's probably the first place you were exposed to him. That's where I was exposed to him originally, was in Chronicles.
Yes,
they
probably
had a piece by the late Samuel Francis deriding what the person he referred to as Little Jemmy Madison, and he talked about the way that James Madison kept switching sides on the question of whether you're creating a strong central government with limited powers, or whether you're creating a central government that's a limited agent of the sovereign states. He couldn't make up his mind on the issue. He was on both sides of the issue at politically convenient times. That was the first time I'd ever been exposed to this. Bear in mind, I was still in college at the time. That was the first time I was exposed to this, and that really set me back in terms of the veneration I had entertained in my estimate of Mr. Madison. Then again, reading the Anti-Federalist Papers when I was in college probably explains why I ended up where I am today, because I really cannot see where they got a whole lot wrong in terms of their detailed and urgent warnings about what this document would do to the independence of the previously independent states and the liberties of the people who were supposed to be protected by their local governments. So, it's a source of disillusionment, isn't it?
last thing I'll say and then let you get on would be, you know, regarding Madison, what's really interesting, if you read the Constitutional Convention debates, he's a very strong nationalist, and he wants the federal government to have a veto over the state governments. But then in the Federalist, I think you've mentioned Federalist 28 and also I think 46, you know, Hamilton and Madison, they both say, well, what should states do if there's unconstitutional laws? And they basically say they should resist, and if necessary, resist through force.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that's overlooked, that in their defense of the Constitution, they said, well, if the states face a federal government that's expanding its powers beyond the constitutional limits, they should resist, if necessary, resist through force.
Yeah, that's the famous insurrectionary passage.
Yeah, so that's really interesting, too. It seems like those Federalist Papers are forgotten, those two.
Oh, entirely forgotten.
On this stuff. Yeah. But anyways, I just wanted to call in because you mentioned Mr. Kaufman and say, rather than yourself and Mr. Kaufman toiling in relative obscurity, you guys deserve to be the leaders of whatever liberty movement is out there, not Limbaugh.
You're very kind. Thank you so much, Eric. God bless you.
They're just functional illiterates and propagandists of power, unlike yourselves.
Ha, ha, ha. Thanks so much.
Okay.
God bless you. It's wonderful to hear from you, and I really appreciate your kind comments. And I share your admiration for Mr. Kaufman. My admiration for him is unbounded and unqualified. So thanks so much for calling in, Eric. Really appreciate it. Yeah, once again, the name of the book by Bill Kaufman, brand new book, or brand new within the last couple of months, is Bye Bye Miss American Empire, Neighborhood Patriots, Backcountry Rebels, and Their Underdog Crusades to Redraw America's Political Map. It's got a beautiful cover, very colorful, very entertaining. You get your money's worth just out of the cover of this book. Bill Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so please stick around.
Memory Crash. Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
866-986-6397 is our call number, 1-866-986-6397 here on the Liberty News Radio Network. Earlier this evening, I made the mistake of referring to it as Radio Liberty. The reason I did that, in case you're curious, is because every Friday night, I'm a guest on a program on Radio Liberty, and for some reason, it's difficult for me to dissociate that network from this wonderful enterprise, which I promote ardently on Radio Liberty. In any case, the previous caller and I were discussing the merits and accomplishments of the wonderful Bill Kaufman and his most recent book, Bye Bye Miss American Empire. This, of course, is an examination, a historical and contemporary examination of the merits of secession in various ways. Secession in the sense of certain states leaving the Union and consolidating in a different union with others, some of them perhaps becoming independent republics or reverting to the status of independent republics or kingdoms. Hawaii, of course, should be a kingdom. It was a kingdom, then it was a republic, then it was stolen by Washington. Puerto Rico, of course, should not be a territory. I don't think that we should have territories. I don't see how a republic can have territories of any sort. The Texas Republic was a republic before it was brought into the Union. There a case to be made for the proposition that California was as well. Very quickly here, I wanted to share with you a couple of gems from the Anti-Federalists and their perspective on the Constitution. And I'm going to reiterate my position on the Constitution. It is a good and useful document, commendable in many ways. It is not divine writ, it is not flawless, and it represents the starting point for any intelligent discussion about how to diffuse power in the interest of protecting individual liberties. Patrick Henry, you remember him, called the Constitution, and I quote, the most fatal plan that could possibly be conceived to enslave a free people. That's really quite strong. In reviewing the literature of the founding era, Mr. Kaufman went through not only the two versions of notes on the Federal Constitutional Convention, he read the notes of the ratifying conventions of 1788. He's one of the few people ever to do that. I slipped back into 1787 to 88, writes Mr. Kaufman, expecting that I would find, among other things, abundant confirmation of my anti-nationalist prejudices. Surely Madison et al. Envisioned these United States as a compact, created by the states and dissolvable by those same states when, as Jefferson wrote in 1776, the regnant form of government becomes destructive. I found no such thing. The convention of 1787, which with equal accuracy might be termed the counter-revolution of 1787, established a unitary national state with federal features. Madison and the framers did not believe the Union to be a compact of equal sovereign states that reserved the right to withdraw from that compact at any time and for reasons of their choosing. Except from the Anti-Federalist dissenters in Philadelphia, notably Luther Martin, and at the ratifying conventions, the consensus among those who wrote and ratified the document was that the states were clearly subordinate to the national government. Now that's, of course, a very discordant summation, given my prejudices and those of Mr. Kaufman in favor of the immutable and undeniable and irrepressible right of people to withdraw from any political arrangement they find unsuitable. Secession, of course, is the oldest and noblest American political tradition, even if you're talking about the secession of one. You're talking about one person who decides that he's going to live at Walden Pond at a strict reserve from the rest of humanity. Or whether you're talking about 13 former colonies declaring that they no longer found it suitable to be considered subjects of a distant monarch. That's the noblest American tradition. The problem is that there was a bait and switch. According to this perspective, articulated by Bill Kaufman and others, in which we ended up with a consolidated mercantilist system that was dominated by an executive from the beginning, inclined to exercise extra-constitutional powers, and Jefferson was as bad an offender in this respect as anybody else. The Louisiana Purchase was not constitutionally supportable. Agreeable, though the outcome in many ways was, the Constitution did not authorize that purchase. And, of course, it was considerably less than agreeable for the Indians who were displaced, beginning with those in the Floridas and the Trail of Tears as a result of what Jefferson did. To the phones we go once again. Jim from Kansas has joined us this evening. Jim, how are you doing? Hello, Jim.
Hello.
Greetings.
Yes. Have you got me now?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
It's good to hear from you.
You know, in talking to people about fiat money, I've kind of discovered that they don't really have any concept of what fiat money is. They think they know. They know it's not real money, you know, but they don't realize mm-hmm. how it comes to be, you know?
Yeah.
Now, if you take a dollar bill and just read the words on it, it says Federal Reserve Note.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go to Black's
That's
Law,
a clue.
And what is a note? It's a promise to pay. But it requires four things. I must pay you X amount by a certain date. That makes it a note.
Makes perfect sense.
Okay, you look on the dollar bill, and only one of those four things is on there, and that's the amount. It's missing three of the other four. And yet it claims to be a note. Isn't that fraud?
Of course it's fraud.
Okay, it would be, except
for Black's
Law. It's
fraud that's forced on us by... I'm sorry?
Except for Black's Law. They say the Federal Reserve Note is similar, and I'm just taking it for context here. It's similar to the real note.
Okay.
But what is the real note? The real note is the guy who creates the money. So if there's no money out there for those brand-new cars sitting on those lots, there's no money
yeah.
for those new houses. It doesn't exist. The bankers don't have it. But the minute you walk in and sign a note, bingo, they are authorized to create the digits to put in your checking
yeah.
account, and you go buy the car.
Yeah, so it's based on debt. It's
Absolutely.
Based on fraudulent
but,
debt.
But whose debt? Well, the individual who signs a note, or the corporation that signs a note, or the government that signs a note. They're all liable for the debt.
Yeah.
And that's where fiat money really comes from. Now, you compare mm-hmm. that to a silver certificate based on real money. And the silver certificate says, and very clear, this certifies there is on deposit in the Treasury of the United States of America $1 in silver payable to the bearer on demand.
Yep. I have a few of those in my collection.
Okay. There's all four things right there. The U.S. Treasury has the dollar they're going to pay you.
Mm-hmm.
Payable to the bearer, the guy that has it in his hand. On demand, when he's demanding it, in the amounts on the corners. See the
difference? Wasn't there an issue of currency that had a notation on it to the effect that it was redeemable in legal currency? It didn't specify gold or silver, but it was redeemable in legal currency.
Well, I don't remember seeing one like that. There might have been.
Yeah, I think in the late 60s there was a brief issue of Federal Reserve notes that had the notation describing them as redeemable in legal currency without specifying what that currency would be, and that, of course, was something that was taken off the Federal Reserve notes very quickly and completely forgotten after 1971, August of that year, when the last connections with gold were severed by
Nixon.
Yeah,
Nixon closed
yeah.
gold window. This is very possible. But the fact still remains, though, we have our new cars and our new this and that and the others because the money can be created for it.
Mm-hmm.
If it was real money, like the gold certificates or the silver certificates, you couldn't loan the money unless the bank had it.
Yeah.
So we'd have to live with a lot less, but we would not have any debt.
That's exactly right. And the biggest misunderstanding, I think, about the way that the economy is structured right now is the idea that we actually have some type of a free market economy in this country, but you can't have a free market economy based on fiat money,
exactly.
Based on an inflatable currency that is backed by debt. If you've got a debt standard that is propping up your currency, you don't have a free market economy. What you're practicing is some form of redistribution of wealth.
Yes. And
because we live in a commercial...
Yeah, let me tell you how that happens.
Okay.
Let's say you build a house for $100,000.
All right.
And let's say that, hypothetically, that $30,000
That's a good price, by the way.
Buying the land and lawyers and so on and so forth, okay? And then let's say that the rest, the $70,000, goes to buying the materials, putting it together, and building the house. Then the guy borrows $100,000, and his payments on that, and I ran one through a little deal that showed me the figures on it, and the payment would have been $733 a month for 360 months or 30 years. Of that, if it was paid in just simple, averaged out, the banker would be taking $456 and actually $278 would have been paid on the house. So the banker is making $455 profit average every month for 30 years.
Mm.
And he had nothing to start with.
It's a staggering fraud. It's like that old parable of stone soup, isn't it? Look, Jim,
well,
thanks
banker,
for your call this evening. Look, we got to go. We got to go to a hard break here. I really appreciate hearing from you. I mean, this is a conversation I'd like to continue some other time. Fascinating and infuriating. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back at you in a minute. one 866 986 6397 is our call-in number here on the Liberty News Radio Network. I appreciate the folks who called in. I'm sorry if it seems as if I've been sort of abrupt in terms of ending the calls this evening. It's not because I don't want to be conducting a conversation. It's just we've had people queuing up, and we've been dealing with hard breaks. And so if I've come off as abrupt, I really, really apologize in all sincerity. I don't want to leave that impression. I value everything that you've been saying, and we've had a number of very interesting conversations this evening about a number of very provocative subjects, not the least of which, once again, is this question of whether the Constitution of the United States is the be-all and end-all, the definitive statement of how to arrange a political system to protect individual rights, and if indeed if this document and the political system it created is what it's been advertised to be by people who venerate the Constitution, the people who talk about restoring the Constitution. Might it be the case that we ought to restore liberty protected by law through some other architecture apart from the Constitutional Union as it was laid out in blueprint form in 1787? That's, I think, a very important conversation to have. And one of the reasons why I am upset, I don't know if upset's the correct word, one of the reasons I'm reflexively suspicious, at very best, of what happened today in Washington, D.C., is the fact that once again we have an effort to centralize, consolidate, homogenize, co-opt, conscript, misdirect a movement that started out with a healthy localist distrust of Washington, D.C. The Tea Party movement was variegated and diversified and local. It was characterized by an abundant and hence healthy hostility toward Washington. And suddenly we have people converging in Washington, D.C. at the feet of the great consolidator, Abraham, Lenin, Mussolini, Lincoln, talking about restoring faith, hope, and charity through what means and to what end? Talk about restoring honor to what? The government ruling us is a thoroughly, incorrigibly dishonorable enterprise. It has a histaminic incapacity to be honorable. If it were a human being, the effort to breathe the ennobling air of honor would leave it with a terminal asthmatic fit. It would collapse in fatal anaphylactic shock. It cannot breathe the air of honor. Or it couldn't if it were an incarnate being as opposed to a murderous abstraction. Our last caller, Jim from Kansas, was talking about fiat money and the fact that it's backed by debt. That's a very important point that is integral to this discussion about secession. Can we honestly expect that in the present political and economic system, we can somehow, by getting the government back into the constitutional cage, we can somehow discharge $202 trillion worth of debt? That's just in the debt-funded spending of the state, or not even the state, the federal government, in terms of what it's accumulated through years now of what are trillion-dollar annual deficits, but also the unfunded liabilities and the Ponzi schemes of various kinds. That's just the federal government segment here. We're not talking about the unfunded liabilities of the states. We're not talking about consumer debt. There's just no way I can see how we're going to escape some kind of systemic political and economic collapse. And the trick, I believe, will be to have a controlled implosion of the Leviathan in such a way that we can get out from underneath it before it crushes all of us. And that means some form of secession, not merely nullification and interposition, worthwhile and commendable as those methods are. We're talking about a definitive sundering of the political ties and the economic liabilities in order to preserve some element of what we earn and the freedoms that we should be able to express. It's going to take some kind of radical separation, which may, in process of time, lead to bloodshed. It's been known to happen before. In his book, Bye Bye Miss American Empire, Bill Kaufman, matter of fact, give me just a second. Let me see if I can find that specific passage. It's right at the end, I believe, of the first chapter. Indivisible, we'll see. As Kirkpatrick Sale of the Middlebury Institute says, all that is necessary is for one state, Vermont, Alaska, or Hawaii, to act. Secession would simply come before the state legislature, both houses would pass it with big majorities, and the governor would send a letter to the U.S. Secretary of State saying that the state is now independent and would be pleased to have diplomatic relations with Washington. Washington could consent, opening Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase's escape hatch, or it could clamp the vice of economic embargo, or it could rain down bombs upon the village squares of Vermont, the caribou of Alaska, the sullen native precincts of the Hawaiian Islands. Weapons of mass destruction would be alleged, methamphetamine production too, and for good measure, sexual misconduct by independence leaders. That strikes me as a very, very good prediction as to how it would play out. Funny, isn't it, how the necessity for violent action and aggression materializes just in time to confer the aroma of necessity, reluctant necessity, on an act which was preordained by the powers that be. Now, once again, talking on the subject of fiat money and the fact that there's nothing behind it, every time we talk about fiat money and the products that are based on fiat money, the bonds, the instruments of debt, the collateralized debt obligations, the derivatives, and so forth, I'm irresistibly reminded of that scene toward the end of Dumb and Dumber. I've talked about this before, but once again, tell me if this isn't exactly the way that the whole fiat-based system operates. Right at the end, in the confrontation between Lloyd Christmas, that of course is the character played by Jim Carrey, somebody I've got a very low threshold of patience for, if you'll forgive me for ending that observation with a preposition, he's confronting the kidnapper with the briefcase that they have dragged all the way from the eastern seaboard to Colorado. And in that suitcase was a large sum of money, millions of dollars, that was supposed to go toward the ransom for the woman who was Lloyd's love interest. And Lloyd and his imbecilic friend Harry Dunn have spent the money, and they've replaced it with little rectangular slips of paper on which IOUs have been crudely scribbled in crayon or magic marker. So when the kidnapper shows up with his gun deployed and pointed at Lloyd and demands the money, he opens up the suitcase, the kidnapper does, and he bellows, "What is this? Where's the money?" At this point, Lloyd, with a smile of almost patronizing self-confidence, replies, "That's as good as money, sir. Those are IOUs. Go ahead and add it up. Every cent's accounted for. Look, see this?" And he holds up a note that was written in his childlike scrawl on what appeared to be a napkin. "That's a car. 275. Might want to hang on to that one." You see, that's pretty much the same racket that the Federal Reserve is involved in right now. Not only, of course, with these exotic debt instruments and these impenetrably opaque instruments of arbitrage, but also those little garishly decorated scraps of rag paper that we're told to call money. There is nothing behind them but this self-perpetuating fraud of debt. That's all that's behind them. And that is why, and tell me if this isn't an ominous development, the Chinese government-connected bankers that have been propping up the dollar for decades now have started, in a measurable, discernible way, to slow down their purchase of treasury notes. They're no longer buying our debt. They're no longer propping up the dollar. And just in the last week, according to a piece that was in the Financial Times yesterday, the Chinese government and the banks that are attached to them, including banks in Hong Kong — Hong Kong, in spite of the fact that it's a special administrative region of China, is freer than the United States right now, incidentally — they're talking about doing business, doing commercial business in the yuan renminbi, the Chinese currency, rather than the dollar. That's because people understand that the dollar, as generated by the Federal Reserve, is about as innately worthwhile as any of those scraps of paper that Harry and Lloyd put into the briefcase when they took out the Federal Reserve notes and spent them. They're not as good as money. They're as good as fiat reserve notes, however. Thus ends hour two of this week's installment of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with hour three. I hope to hear from you then. We'll be back in just a minute or two.